The Anthropocene is the name being given to a new geological epoch defined by the marked impact humans have had on the planet. Elizabeth Colbert writes about the ways that impact will remain in the geologic record for millions of years to come in an article called Enter the Anthropocene, Age of Man. It's in the March issue of National Geographic magazine, and I'm pleased to welcome Elizabeth Colbert back to our show. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Now, I hope I'm pronouncing it right. The Anthropocene?
Well, it's a very interesting question that you raise. It's a neologism. The whole, you know, the word is only about 10 years old. And so people sort of pronounce it different ways, but in the person who created the world is a Dutch chemist named Paul Crutzen, who won the Nobel Prize actually for being one of the discoverers of ozone depleting chemicals, and he actually pronounces it Anthropocene.
Okay,
but
many Americans
pronounce it Anthropocene. So it's
Anthropocene makes perfect sense to me. Is it being accepted throughout the scientific community?
Well, that's another good question. It is, you know, somewhat of a technical term. It refers to a geological era, the way you would say geologists would officially say we're now in the Holocene, which is the period that started at the end of the last ice age, so about 11,000 years ago. And you will widely see the word used in the scientific literature to refer to sort of recent, very recent times. But the question of whether it's going to be officially designated a new geological epoch is still being debated.
Well, how are epochs determined?
Well,
Boundaries between them. Did the Holocene begin when the very last glacier receded from the ice age?
No, there's definitely still a lot of ice around at what we would now consider to be the boundary of the Holocene. There are actually different markers. If you look on the International Commission for Stratigraphy, has a very good website and a very elaborate chart of how you define epochs. There are all sorts of geological ages, epochs, periods, and each one of them has what they call a golden spike, which is an actual sequence of rock that is sort of the reference sequence. Sometimes they're defined by the disappearance of one kind of organism or the appearance of a kind of organism. Sometimes they have almost a chemical boundary. You see changes in chemistry. They can be defined in different ways. And the question of how you would, in fact, define the Anthropocene, something that is so recent, and when exactly, where you would place that border. Would you place it, you know, 200 years ago? Would you place it, you know, today? Where would you place it? Those are all interesting questions.
Aren't stratigraphers, and I hope I'm pronouncing that word correctly, the people who actually look into those changes?
Yes, that is a very significant branch of geology. If you're a stratigrapher, you are occupied with just the sort of questions that we're discussing, which is how do you define a geological age or epoch or, you know, period, and what are the defining markers, and, you know, what caused them? Why are we seeing these changes? Those sort of questions.
Well, they look at rocks and other geological factors from our past. Would they be able to spot any changes that would suggest that we're in a new geological epoch?
Well, that's a really interesting question. A lot of people are thinking about that. Obviously, when you're talking about times past, you're actually, you know, looking at the sedimentary rock record that's been laid down over hundreds of millions, you know, billions of years, actually. If you're looking at today, we don't have that rock record yet, right? We don't have sedimentary rock that's been formed from, you know, 100 years ago. So we're in the process of forming that, and it raises sort of an interesting intellectual puzzles. What would you use in the absence of that rock layer? Now, one chemical marker that people have suggested, which is everywhere, universal, and quite sort of instantaneous, is when we first started doing nuclear testing. There's now a layer of, you know, nuclear isotopes that you could identify all over the world and say, okay, this is a moment where there's a universal sort of marker in the geological record that will basically be there, you know, more or less permanently, and you could use that. So that's one possibility.
Wait, so you find that in a soil strata?
You will find that now in soil, right? Eventually you will find it in rock, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everybody agrees that something is happening. There is a disagreement over whether climate change is man-made. Some people say that it's just a natural cycle, similar to previous ones. But wouldn't that suggest that no matter who's discussing this, that we are in something that could be called we can't call it the Anthropocene, because if you say it isn't man-made, then Anthropocene is a misnomer. Is that it?
Well, there's a couple of things that I would say about that. First of all, in the scientific community, there really is no disagreement at this point that human beings are causing climate change, or certainly no disagreement that human beings are causing very significant change in atmospheric composition. And that change in atmospheric composition, okay, so that release of carbon dioxide that's been buried for hundreds of millions of years, in some cases, tens of millions of years, you know, coal and oil, we're taking CO2 that's been buried for a very long time, we're putting it directly up into the atmosphere. That marker, that change in CO2 levels, that is another possibility. That is something that will also be permanently etched into the record as different living organisms take up that CO2 that we're releasing. So you will be able to see, scientists refer to that as a carbon excursion. It changes the chemical signature in things like the shells of, you know, mollusks and tiny little organisms that make shells that get deposited on the ocean floor that eventually become, you know, limestone. So there's no debate in the scientific community, you know, that those sorts of things are happening.
My guest is Elizabeth Culbert, who has written an article called Enter the Anthropocene, Age of Man, in the March issue of National Geographic magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, if all scientists seem to agree on this, why do you think so many members of Congress and the fact that Americans actually are believing that global warming is man-made, the number seems to be decreasing?
Well, I think we've got to really look, you know, outside the realm of science, and you really have to look at the realm of politics. And if you look at the kind of discourse about this issue that you hear on TV and that you can find on many websites, there's a very clear, you know, political agenda by certain groups who may or may not have their own, you know, vested economic interests to sow doubt about whether there's a relationship between releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and causing climate change. But as I say, there's no doubt. I mean, carbon dioxide is what's called a greenhouse gas. You know, why is it called a greenhouse gas? It's called a greenhouse gas because of the property it has of trapping heat. And there's just no doubt in the scientific community that if you add more CO2 to the atmosphere, that all other things being equal, you're going to raise the average temperatures on the globe. And predictions have been made about this, you know, for ever since people started sort of modeling climate change back in the 1970s. And those predictions are now being borne out. We are seeing average temperatures rise globally.
So, now, why now? The Industrial Revolution put an awful lot of pollutants and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Have geologists been able to measure the impact of that in the middle of the 19th century, or was that negligible compared to what we're doing today?
Well, we can get it. We have a pretty good record of CO2 going back. You know, you get carbon dioxide trapped in the ice and things like that. So we have a pretty good idea of what carbon dioxide levels have been like now going back, you know, many hundreds of thousands of years. And you do find that CO2 levels did start to rise, but very slowly with the start of the Industrial Revolution. And then it really has picked up steam just in the last few decades, really, you know, just since basically since World War II, since this huge, what some people call the Great Acceleration, this huge increase in population and in resource use that we've seen basically since the middle of the 20th century.
Well, go ahead.
No, sorry. So we have very good figures on that.
Well, I understand how that affects greenhouse gases, but how will the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere show up geologically?
Well, as I said, different organisms take up carbon. One thing that you can look at is the makeup of shells. You know, there are tiny marine organisms called foraminifera. They take up carbon when they make these little tiny shells that they make. Those rain down on the ocean floor. So we have long-term records over a long time of that people can try to decipher. It becomes harder and harder. It's not like just taking a sample of the atmosphere, but they're sort of called proxy records, and we can look at things like that and try to infer what carbon dioxide levels were in the atmosphere and how that changed, how the isotopic ratio of carbon changed, and that has other implications. It gets rather complicated, so I'm not going to go into it in great detail right now, and nor would I ever claim to be an expert on that kind of thing. But you can find these records.
What about in the ice cores?
Well, the ice cores, one of the questions that people raise is we're in the process of sort of melting a lot of ice, nor is ice a permanent record, right? You would not call a glacier a permanent record, though they are very long-term records at this point. They're not going to be something that's going to be around 10 million years from now. So I don't think in general people wouldn't say an ice core, is going to leave a long-term record, but it's not going to leave a permanent record. And as I said, since we're in the process of melting off a lot of the world's ice, I don't think that's what you would look to.
There was a report issued today that found that the heavy rains we've seen over the past year that caused floods in Pakistan, China, and Australia are at least in part due to human-created greenhouse gases. Now, is that fact, or is that an inference based on the modeling that we've been talking about?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of fact.
If yes, I were David H. Koch, what would I think?
Oh, you would completely deny it. But once again, I guess I would question what relevance does that have? I mean, if you were someone looking at, what scientists do in these instances is they say, okay, what are the odds? Can we get this to happen? And get it to happen with this kind of increasing frequency, as people say now, what used to be a 100-year flood is, increasingly happening, let's say, every decade. What are the odds that that would be just a statistical fluke, that would suddenly be happening now without any influence of greenhouse gases? And they do very sophisticated mathematics and come up with the answer. In some cases, maybe it is possible, but in many cases, it seems extremely unlikely that that's just a statistical fluke. You probably have to factor in what we're doing to get this kind of a result.
Elizabeth Culbert's article, Enter the Anthropocene, Age of Man, is in the March issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Elizabeth Culbert. She's written an article called Enter the Anthropocene, Age of Man, for the March issue of National Geographic magazine. Well, let's talk about some of the things that we have done that we're almost guaranteed to change the planet. For example, cities.
Right. Well, those are one of the things about thinking about the Anthropocene, as I say, it's sort of an intellectual exercise. What will still be around of us, 10 million, 100 million years from now? So you have to think about what we're doing that really will have a lasting impact. Now, cities are interesting cases. They're obviously, huge expanses of man-made material, steel, rock that we've, quarried different places and moved around the planet, glass. And you have to ask yourself, okay, if you were some being around 10 million years ago and you were digging down and you came across this, what would you make of it? Now, the thing about cities is that, they will get crushed down to nothing, right? So that there'll be all that we see as these tremendous cities will be, buried and compressed. But
wait, similar to what we find with ancient cities that we discover through archaeological digs, or is the fact that we use steel and glass and all sorts of other, and plastic especially, does that mean that they will be very different?
Well, everything, you know, over very, very long periods of time, right, whole geological, you know, periods of time, if you look back in the record, you know, if you actually look at the rock record, you can get, you know, periods of time, millions of years that have been compressed down to, you know, a foot, let's say. I'm just using that as an arbitrary example. In some cases, you know, less than that. So everything just over long periods of time, as dirt piles up and gets compressed and lithified, everything just gets reduced. So we're not talking about the time scale, you know, of when we go back and find ancient Rome. We're talking about the time scale when we go back and find, you know, the end of the age of the dinosaurs, right? And that shows up as a tiny, tiny layer. And then you have to think, what are the odds of hitting a city, right? So if you're going back in time, what you find in the fossil record, what we tend to find and know about, right, are things that were extremely widespread, because what are the odds that you're going to, you know, be digging down and you're going to happen to be over Manhattan? They're not that high. And the continents move around, and what was once land is often underwater. So all sorts of changes that you have to imagine happening over the course, as I say, we're talking about, you know, millions of years from now, what will still be around?
Well, you mentioned the dinosaurs. It's been theorized that an asteroid killed them. Is there any geological evidence that that really occurred? Isn't there? That was popular for a while, and haven't people had second thoughts?
No, on the contrary, that's very, very well established at this point, and exactly what we found, and exactly what would now be considered the marker, you know, for the end of the Cretaceous, which is the sort of end of the age of the dinosaurs, this huge monumental change on the Earth, was found by people looking through the geological record and finding this very weird spike in an element called iridium, which is very rare on Earth, but much more common in outer space. And they were just looking. They were looking for something totally different. A scientist named Walter Alvarez and his father, Luis Alvarez, who's also a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, and they found a very high level of iridium. They said, what could possibly explain this at this particular moment, basically in time when the dinosaurs went extinct? And they inferred from that there had been a major asteroid strike. And there was a lot of controversy for about a decade, and then people went out and actually found the impact crater, which is now mostly underwater off the Yucatan Peninsula. But in fact, there was just an article in Science Magazine. It's now the 30th anniversary, basically, of that theory, and it's been verified over and over and over again at this point. So it's very widely accepted at this point that an asteroid did, in fact, or the effects of the asteroid impact ended the age of the dinosaurs and many other organisms. I should say dinosaurs are just the most famous, but many organisms went extinct at that moment.
Well, right now we're going through a period of large-scale die-offs of plants and animals, and we don't have an asteroid to explain it. Will people a million years from now look at it and say they killed them off themselves?
Well, I mean, you know, some people will say, look, we will look. Our impact will potentially be analogous to an asteroid because, once again, over long periods of time, things that seem to us to be happening slowly over the course of decades or centuries will look, when you look back at this tiny record that's left, as if they happened instantaneously. So depending on, you know, how widespread the extinctions that we, as you say, are in the process of causing, and once again, that's pretty much irrefutable. The only question that, you know, sort of remains is how many organisms our various activities are going to drive to extinction. You know, will that rise to the level of a major extinction event? And increasingly, once again, something I deal with in the article, increasingly scientists are saying it may well rise to that level.
And we're assuming that humans will be around in a million years. We have no guarantee of that.
I don't know that anyone's assuming that humans will be around in a million years. I mean, a million years is pretty much the sort of, you know, rough average lifetime of a species. If we lasted a million years, that would be quite a feat, I think, at this point.
Well, I just saw a documentary about the burial of nuclear waste in Finland in a very, very deep cave. And they're concerned about some people or something coming upon this a million years from now and having no idea, not being able to read Finnish,
That seems like a good bet, doesn't it? Yeah.
and all the warning labels, and not knowing what nuclear waste was, even though it would still be dangerous a million years from now.
Yes, and that's a very there were we in this country don't have a long range nuclear storage facility yet. That's been the huge fight over Yucca Mountain, which I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about. It has never been built, so all of our waste from nuclear power plants is basically just sitting at the power plant where it was created. But a big question, when we eventually do that, if we eventually do that, is precisely the point that you're raising, which is how do you communicate with whatever is going to be around in the lifetime of this waste, which will remain quite radioactive for, many thousands of years, I don't know, about a million years. How do you bridge that gap between us and, potentially some other species?
A listener, John, left a comment on our show page asking, is there any chance that years from now there'll be a layer of plastics in the sediment? They photodegrade into smaller and smaller bits, but I imagine they're beginning to cover the Earth.
That's a really good question. And, ultimately plastics are derived from fossil fuels, which are derived, ultimately going way, way back from living organisms. They will sort of fossilize in some place, some sense. But yes, that might be something that you could say this is a really weird material. This is a layer that's global, you have to be very, very clever, other species or whatever to figure out what it was. But yes, some people have suggested that something like that will be, the same way that we encounter, tiny shells from millions of years ago, people will encounter our plastic waste millions of years from now.
In what ways has agriculture, which is a human creation, changed the Earth?
Really dramatically. Another way that you can go back and look at what was around going way back. I mean, people go back and look at pollen records from way, way back. You sink a core into, let's say, a lake bottom or something like that, where pollen has been building up for a really long time, and you can say, okay, this is what the forest looked like. This is what was growing, in the general area of this lake. So if you go back and now you're going to look at the pollen record, let's say, for the American Midwest, you would see that for a long time it was, prairie grasses, and then, fairly suddenly it was this almost monoculture, let's say, of corn. So that's another way that we are, changing the geological record. We were also obviously resurfacing the Earth in a lot of ways. We're, plowing it. There are erosion patterns that, once again, you'd have to be very clever to sort of infer back to what happened, but we're preventing a lot of silt that used to, for example, run down the Mississippi because we've built levees and things like that, so that silt no longer runs down. And that's one of the problems that Louisiana has, in fact, and why the city is sort of sinking. So we've changed all those sort of patterns.
Can you explain what a reef gap is?
Yeah, a reef gap is, reefs are built out of, basically the same material that, like a clamshell or calcium carbonate. And reefs are, and they're very long-lived in the fossil record, right? So we have reefs that have become, basically rock and are now mountains. Now in the Alps, you see old reefs in Texas. There are old reefs from hundreds of millions of years ago created by organisms that built reefs that are not the same organisms that we have today. They're not the kind of corals that we have today. They're different kind of corals that have gone extinct or sponges or organisms like that. And if you look back in the fossil record after these major extinction events, you see what are called reef gaps, where for a long time you don't see any reefs in the record. And one of the things people have inferred from that is that these events are associated with changes in ocean chemistry that make reef building hard or impossible, depending on what you want to look at. And one of the very ominous things, perhaps most ominous things you could argue that human beings are doing today, is that we are changing the chemistry of the ocean.
So, in fact, one of the stratigraphers that you spoke with says that what's happening now to the oceans will appear in the future to be as sudden and profound as an asteroid hitting the Earth.
Yes, there's...
I would have given his name, but I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
There is a real question about whether what we're doing to ocean chemistry is a result, I should say, of burning fossil fuels. So the CO2 that we're putting up into the atmosphere, a lot of it is getting absorbed by the oceans just because the oceans are always sort of taking up what's in the air. It has the effect of making the oceans more acidic. And there's a real question that scientists have, and we're doing it very fast. In geological terms, it's very, very fast. And there's a real question whether something this rapid, this much ocean acidification is taking place this rapidly at any point in geological time, or whether what we're doing is unique.
Well, you mentioned that it's hard to separate the issue of global warming from politics. The American Clean Energy and Security Act was passed in the House in 2009, but got hung up in the Senate. And since many of the newer members of Congress are opposed to climate change legislation, what do you think the prospects are for legislation that addresses the issue during the current administration's time in office?
Well, I don't think I'm saying anything that, you know, anyone who follows this issue wouldn't tell you, which is, you know, I think the prospects are basically nil. And the only question that really remains, and it's a significant one, is whether Congress is going to try to, I mean, they are going to try to, whether they're going to succeed. The Environmental Protection Agency, there was this sort of key Supreme Court case in 2007 that gave them the power and basically, in some sense, you could say demanded that they regulate greenhouse gases. And they are moving, the Obama administration, the Bush administration sort of dragged its feet, left it to the Obama administration. The Obama administration is moving in that direction. And whether, and many of the members of Congress have declared that they're going to go after the EPA. They're going to basically take that power away from them legislatively or simply hang them up in various ways. So
we're actively going against all of the scientific information.
I know that's shocking to imagine at this point, but yes, we are in the process of very, very actively flouting, you know, and it's sort of it would be funny if it weren't so important that the U.S. government pays for a lot of these studies of climate change, you know, some of the best climate science in the world, all of which increasingly points to very serious consequences, you know, certainly for all other organisms and increasingly for humans and for agriculture and for our cities that are, you know, sitting on very low-lying coastal areas. And we have a Congress now that seems intent on just trying to pretend, and it really is just pretending at this point, that all of that information doesn't exist.
But it's not just the U.S. Congress. We had the U.N.'s climate summit, which failed to reach any consensus. Again, because of politics or economics?
Yes, but not because people attending that conference didn't believe that this was a serious problem, but because it's very, very difficult to fashion a global agreement, a global accord on what to do about it, because some countries are much more responsible for the problem than others. We are the most responsible at this point in terms of just emissions over time. And some countries will bear the effects first, right? If you're a low-lying island nation, you're going to bear the brunt of this soonest. So how you fashion a global accord, and then there are also these very large economies like China, which are now emitting more than the U.S. on an annual basis, but on a per capita basis are still emitting a lot less, and on an aggregate basis are emitting a lot, have emitted a lot less. So how do you fashion, you know, a kind of accord that's fair to everybody and actually deals with the problem? And virtually, you know, no one has sort of figured out how to do that at this point.
I've been seeing commercials, I think, funded by the oil and gas industry that has been pretty much saying, you know, if we don't drill, we're going to lose jobs.
Right.
Is that really the ultimate message of opponents of climate change, the climate change deniers?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that the counter to that, I mean, is that the ultimate argument? You know, I think that the as you've sort of suggested, they've used every argument, right? It's not true, and if it were true, what would we do about it? And if it were true and we tried to actually do something about it, we'd lose jobs. So, you know, every argument, and when you see sort of every argument like that being used, you can sort of bet that, unfortunately, on the other side, there's some significant point, as there is here. And the economics of it all are you know, they are very complicated, but an argument that could be made on the other side is, and has been made on the other side, is that the jobs of the future, right, where are we going to get our energy from in the future, are in new industries or in carbon, low carbon or carbon-free forms of energy. So I was just down in D.C., and as you say, you can find these competing billboards. There was the Wind Association had their billboards up, and the oil and gas people had their billboards up. So we are definitely fighting over you know, what should our energy agenda be? And unfortunately, there's always there are the jobs of the present, right? And then there are jobs of the future, and people hold the jobs of the present right now, so they often have more political clout, even though we're really just, you know, delaying the inevitable, which is some kind of transition to new energy sources. Because if nothing else, and unfortunately there is something else, which is climate change, but if nothing else, these fossil fuel resources will run out, right? So eventually we have to make this transition. It's a question of when.
We have about 20 seconds to go, but I wonder if you're filled with despair or feeling frustrated at the fact that we're still debating this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You cannot make any progress till you agree, you know, basically on a certain set of facts, and we're still running around not agreeing with them, which is, you know, sort of like running around and, you know, debating evolution. It's just, you know, sort of time to move on.
You mean you believe in evolution?
I guess I'm convinced, yeah. You can put me in the convinced column.
Elizabeth Colbert is, her article, Entered the Anthropocene Age of Man, is in the March issue of National Geographic magazine. Thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thanks for having me.
The Obama administration has approved more than $100 billion in arms sales to the Middle East alone over the last 2 years. On tomorrow's show, we will look at why weapons are one of the U.S.'s leading exports. Then, Mackenzie Phillips on her complex relationship with her father, Mamas and Papas singer John Phillips. Also, computer scientist Zachary Mason on his creative reimagining of Homer's Odyssey. And we will look at how Russia has been transformed and yet has remained the same for most of its people since the fall of communism. Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Blakeney Schick, Julia Corcoran, and Christina Maldonado. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Jessica Ramey and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.